Campus FM presents a JMER lecture, Chew on This, exploring Maltese children's food and nutrition knowledge, perceptions and behaviours by Dr. Suzanne Piscopo.
On behalf of the editorial board of JMER, the Journal of Maltese Education Research, I welcome you to the first annual JMER lecture. A few words about the journal. First of all, the Journal of Maltese Education Research is an electronic journal. It is published twice a year, and it is fully refereed. Okay? It is generally published June and December. It was first published in February 2003, so this, we have reached the volume 4, number 1, and which is due in June this year. JMER is a success story. We have over 1,000 subscribers, approximately 700 Maltese and approximately 300 foreign subscribers. Subscription is free, and if you want to access the journal for free, again, the address is over there. It's www.eduk.um.edu/mt/JMER. We have an archive too, so you can also access volumes 1 through 3. Okay, so that's the details regarding the journal. The journal is not just volumes 1 and 2 per year. It's also a series of happenings, and this is, in fact, one of the happenings, the first JMER annual lecture. We also have an annual JMER seminar, usually held in November, and this year it will focus on the teaching profession. So, as you can see, it's not limited to publishing, foregrounding Maltese research through paper publication, but it also extends as far as lectures and seminars. So that's all about the journal. Let me introduce you to Dr. Suzanne Piscopo, who is a colleague of mine within the Faculty of Education. To be exact, she's also the coordinator of the Home Economics Program within the Department of Math, Science and Technical Education, which is one of the five departments that constitute the Faculty of Education. Her lecture is on the screen, Chew on This, Exploring Maltese Children's Food and Nutrition, Knowledge, Perceptions and Behaviors. This lecture is being recorded, courtesy of Campus FM.
So good evening and welcome. Thanks for coming along this evening. Happy Women's Day to all of the females here. Thank you to the gentlemen as well, however, for coming along. And this, as Dr. Carmen Borch explained, is the first lecture, the commemorative, in a sense, lecture for JMER, and I'm very honored and I thank Dr. Borch for giving me this opportunity to be the first person to actually present this annual JMER lecture. So I think we'll start without more ado, and as you can see, the title of my presentation is Chew on This, Exploring Maltese Children's Food and Nutrition, Knowledge, Perceptions and Behaviors. This work, what I'm going to be presenting today, is accumulation of many years of research collecting as part of my doctoral study. I will in fact be focusing only on a part of the results from my doctoral study, as I'll explain as I go along. Very quickly again, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Carmel Borch for this opportunity, but I'd also like to acknowledge Professor Lynn Davis and Dr. Wolf Markham, who were my doctoral supervisors in the UK. So let's start off. I'll just give you a quick overview as to what I'll be talking about. So it's kind of the menu of the day. I thought it might be a bit appropriate to follow this this analogy. So I'll just, in the next slide or two, give you an overview of the study design and the background of my research. Then we'll go into the main course, the meat of the presentation, and we'll try to answer these questions. What do children know and think about food and health? What are some general trends in children's eating habits? And what attracts children to different foods? Finally, to conclude, we'll be looking at the implications and recommendations for action. So, as a quick background, my doctoral research focused on 7 to 8 year old Maltese children, and there were two methodologies which were used, quantitative and qualitative methodologies. With regards to the quantitative methodology, I conducted a survey with over 1,000 Maltese 7-8-year-olds. When I say Maltese, I'm also referring to Gozzetan children. And then, bless you. And then I also conducted a survey with their parents, with these children's parents. As you can see, I had over 1,000 children, and nearly all of the parents also participated, so it was a very good response rate. The goal of the survey was to identify eating habits and food preferences of the children. Then I also had a qualitative component to the research study, and here I conducted focus groups with children. I had 16 focus groups. Each focus group had 6 children. They were generally mixed gender, except for schools which are single gender, either all female or all girls schools. And here the goal of the focus groups was to look at influences on food consumption. So in the survey, I looked at what they were eating and what they preferred eating, but in the focus groups, I asked them, in a sense, what was influencing them. I didn't ask them that directly. Oftentimes, I did it in a roundabout manner, but the goal was to uncover what influenced their food consumption. And finally, then, as a final follow-up to these, to the two previous steps, I also conducted phone interviews with 30 parents. Out of the 30 parents, in fact, 29 were mothers. I had asked for the person who was the main provider, food provider in the household, and in fact, generally we had the females, the mothers, who responded. And here I conducted interviews, as I said, phone interviews with these mothers and one father, and the goal was to find out what influenced these food providers, the mothers, the fathers, as to what they gave their children. So I tried, this is called triangulation, looking at different sources of information to try to answer your main research question. So let's start looking at some of the facts and what I found out. I'm going to start off by telling you what children knew or what children perceived with regards to food and health. And through the conversations which I had with the children, they started sometimes referring to something which they labeled as good food. When you see something in italics, generally that means I'm using the same terminology, the same words, the exact words which children used. So they started talking about good food. And when I explored this further, these are their meanings, in a sense, their meanings, what they were referring to when they said good food. So they were referring to things like food which gives you energy. So good food gives you energy. Good food contains vitamins, giving you health and healthy brain cells. One child said, and healthy brain cells. Good food makes you hungrier. That was interesting too. Good food does not lead to illness. Good food helps to prevent illness. You might say they're a bit similar. Good food does not contain products which harm the body. And finally, good food does not contain sugar. So here we already start seeing that they were linking good food with, in fact, protecting themselves against disease, against harm. They were also, however, already pinpointing certain substances which could, in fact, improve your health, such as they mentioned the word vitamins, or as a corollary to that, they also identified certain substances which perhaps could lead to ill health, which was in fact sugar. So let's see a little bit more as to what was happening here. I tried to get a bit more detail with regards to the quantity, their perception of quantity of food intake and its link with health. So as I had said earlier, one child, for example, said good food increases your appetite. And in fact, a boy was referring to this, and he said that it's acceptable to have a high intake of this food. So he had this idea that if the food was good, it was good to have a lot of that food. Obviously, to a certain extent, this is somewhat correct in the sense that if you have a good food, in a sense what we would recognize as a nutritious food, it's okay to have a certain amount, but in fact, any kind of food really, if taken in excess, will probably have some kind of repercussions. In fact, when I asked this boy a little bit further why he was saying this, it seemed that obviously his mother was encouraging him, and I do remember he specifically mentioned his mother, to really consume a lot of certain foods which she was proclaiming were very healthy. However, what was also interesting was that certain children, remember, we're talking about 7 to 8 year olds here, that certain children were in fact already aware of the need to balance. and the need for balance, not only in quantity, but also in variety of food. And here I'm actually going to quote what two children said as they were talking during the focus group. This is what they said. We have to eat all kinds of food. We need to vary, because otherwise we'll get fat and we'll break our chair if we eat a lot. Then the second child responded, but eating only vegetables isn't good, because always, always vegetables, never changing. Or always pasta or chips, it's not right, a little bit of everything. So here you actually have a very good definition of balance and variety, and this is coming from a 7-year-old Maltese child. Obviously somebody there was already educating them with regards to this concept of balance and variety. Could have been the teacher, or could have been somebody within the home, the family environment. Then I tried to gauge, or try to explore really, what children saw as healthy when it comes to food, or not so healthy. So which foods children labeled as healthy, and which foods children labeled as not so healthy. And here I'm giving you the main findings, in the sense of the foods which stood out in either one or the other category. So when we're talking about healthy food, these are the foods which children mentioned. Under healthy, they mentioned brown bread, lettuce, tomatoes, banana, water, and salami. Then, under not so healthy, they mentioned salami again, oil, crisps, and Nutella. So if you look at these two columns, now these were not the only foods which were mentioned, but these were the foods which were mentioned most frequently. Okay? Many of these foods listed here are in fact listed or categorized correctly by the children. Brown bread, lettuce, tomatoes, banana, and water as healthy, and not so healthy we have the high fat and with regards to the Nutella, high fat and high sugar food. What was interesting was the salami. And so those children who refer to salami as maybe not so healthy were more correct, whereas those children who labeled salami as healthy were obviously less correct. But I tried to find out a little bit more why that happened. And I asked the child again, it was a boy in this case, and I asked him, why do you feel that salami is healthy? And his answer was, because I see this advert on television and the footballer says he consumes this kind of salami. So obviously there it was the influence of advertising, and obviously he was associating this type of food with a footballer he would associate with somebody who's energetic, healthy, obviously doing well in his career, probably somebody who would be very famous, and so there was this positive association, and this was as a result of advertising. We'll be talking more a little bit more about this later on. I actually tried to delve a little bit deeper, and this is the advantage of focus groups, because when you are conducting focus groups, if something is mentioned, you have the opportunity to delve deeper and try to find out even more clearly, if you want to say that, why certain answers are being given. So I actually asked children, but why and what criteria, I don't actually use again this terminology, but I was trying to find out, you know, what criteria they used to justify a food as being healthy. And this is where we actually got some really interesting information. So sometimes they classified a food as being healthy because they actually thought of the food group to which that food belonged as being healthy, and the clear examples of these were fruits and vegetables. So any kind of fruit or vegetable, they classified it as healthy because they came from the fruit or vegetable group. Then sometimes they classified a food as healthy because it maybe contained another healthy ingredient. So if they mentioned a food and it either contained cereal or potatoes or oranges or meat or milk or honey, if the food they mentioned contained any one of those ingredients, then they felt that that food was healthy. So it's interesting again to see how they were already looking at, you might have a food which is processed, or something like a pizza, for example, or a pasta dish, and if it contained any one of those ingredients, then they felt that that dish was healthy. Sometimes they also stated that a food was healthy, they explained, because it had a nutritious or a beneficial substance. And the two items which they mentioned were vitamin C and fiber. So already at age 7 or 8, these two words were part of the children's discourse, part of their conversations. Sometimes they said they classified foods as healthy because that food did not contain an ingredient which they perceived as unhealthy. So if a food did not have an ingredient which they normally considered an unhealthy ingredient, then that food was healthy. Which were the unhealthy ingredients they were thinking of? When I asked them, they said, well, an unhealthy ingredient would be chocolate or sugar or oil or yeast. That was a bit strange. I couldn't find out more why they mentioned yeast. Coloring or fizz. Fizz is the carbonation. So some children were saying if there were these ingredients in a food, it made them unhealthy. If these ingredients were not there, it made the food healthy in their eyes. And finally, they also said that if a food was in its natural state or it was minimally processed, then they considered that food as healthy. And here two items which were frequently mentioned were the brown bread, which they considered as not being so processed, and they were correct, of course, and raw cauliflower. This tended to come up quite a lot. Apparently, maybe at that time, they may have seen something or heard something, encouraging them to eat raw vegetables, in particular raw cauliflower. Then I did the same thing, but the other way around. So what criteria were they using to classify food as not so healthy? So, In a similar way, if they thought a food belonged to a food category or group which they perceived as healthy, then that food was unhealthy. And here, for example, they had they mentioned chocolate, Nutella and crisps, which they classified as sweets, and in their mind sweets were not so healthy. And they also mentioned oil, which they classified under the fats group. Now it's interesting there that they mentioned crisps as sweets. This is a phenomenon which has emerged over and over in my research and even in some BEd students' research as well. Maltese children classify crisps as sweets. Sweets is an umbrella term not only used for sugary or sweet tasting snacks, but any kind of snack really. Okay, il helu, as we say in Maltese, al-yom, even things like packet snacks, so savory packet snacks, falls under this umbrella. So that eventually has repercussions when it comes to sort of the content of those foods, because to them, in fact, crisps, they actually associated with containing sugar, which we'll see later on. Food, and of course, then they neglect the salt aspect, which is a lacunae. Food, they also, if a food contained an ingredient which they perceived as unhealthy, then that made it unhealthy. And these are the ingredients which they mentioned as making a food unhealthy. Pork, fat, oil, chocolate, sugar, salt, vinegar, acid, and fizz again. So fizz again emerged as something which making a food unhealthy, which really and truly is not really the case. I mean, carbonation will not have such a detrimental effect on our health at all. Then the other way around is what we saw with regards to what makes a food healthy. It also applied here. If a food lacks an ingredient which is perceived as healthy, and here this wasn't mentioned often, but I remember one or two children saying, if the seeds are missing in white bread, then that food is unhealthy. Obviously, they had heard something that, you know, maybe breads which contain seeds and you know, pieces of grains, etc., those things make the bread healthier. So if those things were not in the bread, then the bread was not healthy. Finally, they also mentioned that if a food has a substance which they perceived as unhealthy, then that food was unhealthy. And they specifically mentioned cholesterol. And even at age 7 and 8, many children were mentioning cholesterol. I'll talk a little bit later on about this as well, but it is interesting to see that it's part of their discourse already, and that they are aware of cholesterol, they're aware of it as a substance which is linked to ill health, or which could lead, in a sense, to ill health. Some other examples of criteria which they use to classify food as not so healthy. If the food has a flavor linked with an unhealthy ingredient, so the flavor, so anything which tastes sweet, basically, they linked with sugar, and therefore it made it unhealthy. But things which they mentioned over and over again were squashes, such as orange squash and peach squash. So they labeled them as unhealthy because they tasted sweet. Some also mentioned frying, so if the food was cooked in unhealthy, using an unhealthy cooking method, and it specifically mentioned frying. And this was interesting. This actually came from one student only, but I put it in because it was interesting to see how children's minds think. If a food is unfit for consumption, this particular child actually said, I avoid salt because maybe the salt comes from a dirty salt pan. So here it was a matter of food safety with regards to food hygiene. Interestingly enough, these young children were actually quite perceptive, and they made comparative statements as well. Obviously, they were receiving some kind of education either from school, again, either it could be from the family, or maybe they were hearing some positive things on the media as well. We can't say that the media is only passing on incorrect or negative messages, not at all. And the children made some comparative statements such as brown bread is healthier than white bread, packet orange juice is healthier than orange squash, olive oil is healthier than sunflower, there's less fat in chicken than in red meat, there are more sugars than cereals in cereal bars. So it was interesting that some children had already reached a sort of a level of cognition where they could make these comparative statements. What is also interesting that some of them were saying that food is good and bad, and this brings up the issue that yes, they often receive also mixed messages. Again, we mentioned the salami here, I already explained perhaps why there was this mixed message with regards to salami being good and bad, but then they also mentioned things like crisps, cookies and cereal bars. With regards to the crisps, why were they kind of confused as to, you know, is it good and bad? Well, they said because crisps is from potatoes and potatoes is a vegetable. So really vegetables are good for us, so crisps are good for us. But then okay, they were also aware that crisps often contain oil. They didn't tend to mention the salt. This is something which was missing from the children's conversation. They did mention salt now and again, but few of them did so. It seems as if we're not emphasizing enough with children that many of the foods which they are eating are actually high in salt. And that is detrimental to their health. With regards to cookies and cereal bars, why were they, again, confused? They're both good and bad, they were saying to me. Well, the main reason which emerged here, and we'll also see this later on, but I'll mention it quickly now, is because they perceived cookies and cereal bars as containing milk. So anything which contained milk then had to be healthy. So that's also something which, you know, we start to see how children are reasoning. They also said things like, sometimes a small amount of a food is acceptable. And again, these were the key foods which they mentioned, salami, olive oil and salt. Very clearly, salami is a major food, if you want to say that, in children's diet, because it kept coming up over and over again. I'm sure it must be a food which they have quite often in their packed lunches. So here they said, a small amount of food, of this food is acceptable. So again, they weren't incorrect here. Salami, olive oil and salt, if you take it in small amounts, it's okay. The other two were similar. You need to limit the frequency of this food. And here they referred to salt and sugar. So they were aware that they need to limit the frequency of consumption, not having it too often. Now, so it's not only the amount, but also the frequency of consumption. And again, need to curtail quantities eaten, not eat so much of this food product. And here they mentioned, so cutting down on how much you eat. It's a bit different from not eating so much, cutting down, okay? And here they were referring to eggs and packet snacks. So obviously they were receiving messages, especially with regards to packet snacks, maybe from school as well. We need to cut down on the number of packet snacks which we eat. With regards to eggs, again, there's still a little bit of, well, not really a controversy. The scientific message or the scientific body at this stage is saying it's okay to have an egg a day if you really don't have any other sources of cholesterol in your diet. Obviously, if you have other sources of cholesterol in your diet and you also have an egg every day, then there could be problems. Positive health links. Here children were looking at, or I actually asked children as to if you eat a certain food, what is its impact on your health? Okay, and so first we looked at foods which they felt had a positive impact on health in different ways. And then we also looked at foods which they felt had a negative impact on their health. Obviously, they weren't always correct. So, for example, they said things like brown bread, bananas and orange juice helps to maintain or promote health, a very general statement. But they also, some of them also said that hot dogs help to maintain or promote health. Again, very likely influence of advertising here. foods which aid bone strength, they mentioned milk, fish and water accurately, but they also said bananas help bone strength. So again, we see this is where there are the incorrect, where children have incorrect knowledge, and this is where we need to come in and correct it. Aids eye health, they mentioned carrots, lettuce and fish, which is correct. Aids in weight management, they mentioned brown bread and skimmed milk, which is also correct. With regards to negative outcomes, so foods which the children said, if you eat these foods, they threaten health. Interestingly, they mentioned packet breadcrumbs. Here it was more a matter because it's a processed food. Children were capable, were able to talk about things like colorings, we also mentioned it earlier, and additives. They were mentioning these foods, or these substances. So that is the reason why they also put packet breadcrumbs there. They didn't say fresh breadcrumbs, they specifically said packet breadcrumbs, okay? As many of you know, they are quite dark orange in color. Obviously, they will have salt added and other ingredients as well, other preservatives, additives. So the children somehow knew about this. They also mentioned Nutella as threatening health. With regards to what leads to high blood pressure, they accurately mentioned salt, but in a sense, inaccurately, they mentioned sweets. Now, if we had to, in a sense, indirectly, sweets could lead to high blood pressure, because if you over-consume sweets, you will become overweight, obese, and obesity, overweight could lead to high blood pressure. But somehow, I don't think the children had made that two sort of step link. So this was inaccurate when they were saying that sweets leads to high blood pressure. They did mention, which was interesting, obviously they didn't use this terminology, but they did say in Maltese, they obviously were hearing this, Gidi Olvini. So, foods which lead to vascular narrowing or blockage. And these were the foods which they mentioned, chocolate, Nutella, and fat and oil, which were accurate. Then they also mentioned apple peel. And I asked about this, and this is apparently something which grandparents somehow had been saying to them, I don't know if it's an old wives' tale or something like that, but that apple peel can block your arteries, okay? So obviously we know that apple peel is a source of fiber, if you want to say that, and it can help rather than to block our arteries, etc., to lead to narrowing. It can actually help to keep us healthy, let's put it this way, and absorb cholesterol, etc. They also mentioned that a food, and they particularly mentioned brown bread, helps to control the fat in your blood. So controlling blood lipids, and they didn't use again these terms, blood lipids, but they said brown bread helps to control the fat in your blood. So that was correct as well. Just to give you one example of the conversations and how these things were mentioned during the focus group. One of the focus groups, we were talking about these food health links, and a child had mentioned Nutella and how it's not so good for health. SP are my initials. So Nutella is sweet. So what happens then? The child said, it increases your blood pressure and sugar. Have you sometimes heard them say this? Yes, on TV. So again, here I'm highlighting that TV is passing on messages about health. In a sense, it can also contribute to accurate messages. Here, Nutella does, in fact, increase your blood pressure, not really because of the sugar, but because of the fat. But yes, of course, Nutella does also increase the sugar in your blood, in your body. Food associations. Now, these were a few things which emerged. And again, as educators, we have to be a little bit careful. Children often mention the term diet foods, okay? But in a sense, unfortunately, they were associating these diet foods with people who wanted to lose weight or people who wanted to avoid gaining weight. And specifically, they were mentioning skimmed milk and also brown bread, but skimmed milk emerged most often. Now, the problem here is that if they're going to associate this food just with those scenarios, these diet food, you know, it's a diet food, skimmed food is diet food. Well, then when we come along and try to encourage them to consume low-fat milk, skimmed milk, and other maybe, you know, low-fat products, they're going to say, but why should I? I don't want to lose weight. I don't want, you know, I'm okay. So if they make these links, then it's going to be a barrier to consumption, all right? So this is something which was happening pretty often. They were referring to things like skimmed milk and brown bread in particular as diet foods, okay? Obviously, again, they were probably hearing conversations amongst adults, maybe on TV, but even amongst adults at home or elsewhere, and referring to these foods as diet foods. Skimmed. Similarly, they also associated particular foods, again in this case brown bread emerged most often, with groups of people. And here they associated brown bread with elderly people, with diabetics, and with those trying to reduce blood cholesterol. So again, there is this negative association. Children are associating a food which we are trying to promote as a healthy food, which would like them to consume more, but they associated with certain groups of people, with elderly people, with diabetics, with those trying to reduce cholesterol. Remember a particular child saying, cholesterol. So to them, they make these links. So we have to be, in a sense, we have a barrier, unfortunately, already, which we have to work around because of these links children are making. And the case of milk was quite a particular case. Again, there were mixed messages apparently coming across to children. Some children did not seem to perceive milk and dairy products as healthy items. First of all, when I asked a bit more about this, they said because some milk has a lot of fat, some milk doesn't have a lot of fat. So they kind of were a bit confused as to where to place milk. And more so, they were again associating milk with obesity and cholesterol. And when I asked, in a sense, they were saying because milk is fattening or milk is linked to cholesterol, I was asking them, but why? And they were mentioning these conversations they would hear in the home. عشان لنا سابولا الكوليسترول وطبيب قال لا أقطع الحليب أقطع الفريت مامولي من الحليب يو عشان البرزمبيو المامي تريتون أس ولو ما أقطعت كينت الحليب البرودكت تاع الحليب. They were saying these kinds of things. So again, we have these barriers which we have to overcome when we're educating, because they're making links with particular groups of people, with particular situations which are not really relevant to them at this stage. On the other hand, they did, as I explained earlier, some of the children seemed to perceive any food containing milk as healthy. So as I said earlier, cereal bars, chocolates and cookies, for some children, they're healthy. Why are they healthy? Because they contain milk. This is just one quote, because they, and the child was referring to cookies, contain milk, and milk is good for the teeth. So that's why I eat cookies. Okay, so again, one has to be careful. Where are they getting these ideas? Oftentimes from the media, believe it or not. Okay, but even parents sometimes, because when I myself also talk to parents, and I spoke to the parents as part of this research, they'll tell you, but you know, chocolate is made from milk, so chocolate is good. And sort of they give this message, they pass on this message to the children. Again, we're never saying, and as many of you know, people who know me, we would never say never to consume chocolate, never to consume cookies, etc. But these are the items which we need to reduce and which we need to put across, the message we need to put across to children is they need to eat less of. It seems that the message children are receiving with regards to milk, that it's good for dental health, it's good for your teeth, which is a correct message. But we're missing out another part of the message which we could put across, that milk is also good for bone strength, and milk is actually good for growth, for physical growth, to build a healthy body, healthy muscles, healthy skin, etc. So this is something which we need to work upon, that in schools, in different settings where we are talking about milk and its benefits for health, that we don't only mention its link with dental health, but we also mention its link with bone health, physical growth, etc. Obviously, it may be a bit easier for children to understand the link between milk and teeth because they can actually see their teeth, okay? With bones, of course, they can feel them, but they can't see them. So just from an assimilation point of view, it's easier for them to see the link between milk and teeth. Quickly, some other misperceptions. These are the things which during the conversations emerged. The health value of skimmed milk due to the absence of salt and sugar rather than fat. Some children thought that, you know, skimmed milk is good not because it has less fat but because it has less salt and sugar. Hot dogs are a very healthy food due to there being a meat product. So if it's a meat product, then it's good. Okay, it's a healthy food. Bread is fattening. This is a misperception which a majority of the people in our society still have, unfortunately. So this also emerged with children. And they also said the custard is healthy because it contains some beneficial substance. Well, it's not totally incorrect, but it's not totally correct either, okay? Crisps and packet snacks contain sugar and lead to tooth decay. So this is where, as I told you earlier, since they classify crisps and packet snacks as sweets, then they think that they contain sugar. And they actually said that they lead to tooth decay. Okay. Oil leads to tooth decay, again, because they associate crisps and some packaged snacks as having oil, so these things, which they label as sweets, so these things also lead to tooth decay. Sweets increase blood pressure and salt is fattening. These are some of the misperceptions which children had and which need to be corrected. With regards to nutrients, remember, we're talking about 7 to 8 year olds. I did not expect them to have knowledge of nutrition, but they did mention nutrients. However, we need to be careful because although they were mentioning nutrients, from the conversations and from the prodding I did to get a bit more information, it was clear that sometimes they were just using these terms without really knowing what they meant. So they had incorrect and correct perceptions of functions and sources of different nutrients. They mentioned things like fat, cholesterol, sugar, sucrose, fiber, vitamin C and D, calcium and iron. They mentioned these, but as I said, one should not assume that these children really understood the meaning of these terms. I'll tell you, you'll see from these quotes how sometimes they had correct information and sometimes incorrect information. So these are quotes from the conversations I had with children. You have a lot of fat in the oil. So that is kind of correct. They seem that somebody here seem to know that actually there's something called fat in the oil. Cholesterol is fat in the blood. Okay, so that's partly correct. White milk has more vitamins, I think. I remember a girl saying this. Well, again, here the child is not really correct, okay? White milk has more vitamins, I think. She was comparing white milk with flavored milk. Flavored milk has more calcium than normal milk. Again, when I tried to find out why that child was saying that, she had actually, she consumed flavored milk, and this particular brand of flavored milk on the packaging had a good source of calcium. So she associated that flavored milk had a lot of calcium, but then she sort of incorrectly made the statement that it has more calcium than normal milk. I have juice at breakfast because it has vitamins and calcium. It says so on the packet. Now, in this case, she was probably correct. Probably she was consuming a juice which had added vitamins and added calcium. That is often the case in many juices, and they will have added calcium written on the package. Breakers has vitamin C. It gives you energy. I think all of you know Breakers is a food drink. It does have vitamin C added. The child said it gives you energy. Well, Breakers, of course, does give you energy, but the child was making the link that vitamin C gives you energy. So there, that was an incorrect piece of knowledge with regards to the nutritional value of vitamin C. Why was this misperception there? Well, as I tried to find out a bit more, and the idea I got was this. As you probably are well aware, many times when people are ill, the doctors or somebody or even the patient themselves will say, don't give, T-lifted vitamini, in a sense, to boost my energy again. And sometimes the other way around, doctor will say, I'll prescribe some vitamins, etc. But the thing is, it's vitamin B which is helping to increase energy, etc., not vitamin C. But somehow or other, they were making this, the children had also assimilated this idea that it's vitamini, high communal energy, yeah. Okay, but more so, a very common misperception was anything which is nutritious contains vitamins. Okay, that was a common, vitamini. Okay, so this was something, again, here we clearly see that really the nutrition is a bit beyond 7, 8 year olds. Yeah? Not all of it, but it would be unfair to assume that children are understanding. Let's look a little bit at consumption now. I looked at what children were eating in 10 different settings. These are the settings where I asked children, what are you most likely to consume and what would you prefer eating in that setting? And these are settings, children, where children, Maltese children, tend to consume food. Breakfast, school packed lunch, after school meal, the meal which they take when they go home, snack at home, weekday supper, Sunday lunch, eating out, maybe going out and then stopping for a snack, going out for a Sunday drive or something and then stopping for a snack, at the beach and as a drink. Now, before I actually give you some answers, let's do a little bit of a quiz here. These were the 6 breakfast foods which children could choose from as to which one they consumed most often. So, a show of hands. How many of you think that tea with milk is what they consumed most often? What about cereal with milk? Okay, what about orange, just a freshly squeezed orange? Okay, the bread roll with butter and coffee? A few. This, like a milk pudding of sorts? a few again, and toast with butter and coffee. A few. Well, actually, the majority of you said cereal, and in fact, the answer is this. Most children consumed cereal with milk, but then a good number also had just tea with milk, and a good number just had a freshly squeezed orange juice. Okay, so the first one is okay. Obviously, we need to promote that children have cereals which are hopefully lower in sugar and maybe, where possible, have also a good fiber content. But those children who just had a drink, one has to be a bit careful. Obviously, it's not a substantial breakfast there. What was interesting was that those who had, there were a number of children who had orange juice, which is good in itself, but what was interesting was that when I asked them how many of you would prefer having, in a sense, orange juice, there were a lot more children who would actually prefer having orange juice. So in a sense, maybe if those children were offered orange juice, they would have it in the morning. So what I'm saying is, so many children said they consumed orange juice, but there were more children who would actually prefer having orange juice as well in the morning. Let's do weekday supper quickly. These were the six foods which I had actually got from a preliminary survey as part of this study, where I tried to find out which were the foods most consumed in different settings, and then I took the top six, and then from those the children had to choose the top one which they consumed. And here we had pizza, spaghetti, fish, minestra, meat with some vegetables and potatoes, and rabbit. Again, let's say, show of hands. So weekday supper, which one do you think they consumed most? Let's say this group of over 1,000 Maltese children, what did they consume most for supper? Pizza? Okay, clearly the majority seems to be here. Spaghetti with tomato sauce? Again. Okay, so it seems to be half and half here. Fish with lettuce and tomatoes? Nobody. Vegetable soup? Oh, we had one person. Vegetable soup, a few. Meat with vegetables and maybe some potatoes, quite a few as well. And rabbit, sort of rabbit stew or some kind of rabbit dish. Yes, please. Well, let's see the answer. You were right. You see, pizza and spaghetti actually came out the same. They were the most consumed. What was interesting was the third one. It was the rabbit. Quite a few children were having rabbit even during the week, and that surprised when I asked them. And obviously, yes, the region did make a difference, but it seems to be that rabbit is becoming more of a sort of a normal thing to have, not just relegated only to Sundays, okay? So that is kind of interesting, maybe also because there's greater availability even in supermarkets as a frozen product and so on. So, last one quickly, and then we'll move on. Eating out. Again, we had pizza, different types. Again, rabbit. Just chips with ketchup, tortellini with white sauce, and then the fast food style, if you want to say that, burger, chips, and either lemonade or milkshake. So let's start. Pizza margherita, with, do you think, you know, which they consumed most? About one third of you. Pizza maltilla, not so many. Rabbit, no. The chips with tomato ketchup, a few. Tortellini. A few, not so many. And the burger meal. Majority. Okay, you win. All right. Yes, obviously, it was the burger meal. Okay. But then the second one was chips. Okay, chips with ketchup. And the third one was the plain pizza margherita. All right. So those were the foods which children were consuming most often. Obviously, here... Okay, what I have here, actually you can see this probably because we're not such, the room isn't so large. These are the key findings. I've tried to put it very quickly in a table. These are the settings on the side, and here you have the food which was consumed most in that setting and the food which they would have preferred most in that setting. Okay? Cereal with milk. So again, we need to encourage children to have cereal which is low in sugar and possibly higher in fiber. Pizza stands out in different meals. So we need to work with children to, pizza's okay, but the topping needs to be carefully chosen. So let's work with children in creating healthy toppings. More vegetable based. It doesn't matter if there's some tuna and fish on it. It doesn't matter if there's chicken on it. It's becoming fashionable now as well. But try to avoid, please try to avoid those high fat, sausages, salami, pepperoni, pizzas. It is such a shame that we are giving children those toppings on our pizzas. Chicken legs with potatoes. Obviously, I didn't do all the settings with you. For Sunday lunch, The children loved the chicken legs with potatoes, okay? And they loved it. They actually consumed it a lot, and they actually liked to consume it. So that is something good, okay? That's something good. It's a good meal. Again, chicken emerged for going out and stopping for a snack. Although they consumed most the burger meal, but they would actually have preferred the chicken nuggets and chips. So chicken is a meat which is probably has more favor with children than actually the red meat, huh? Which is good. Now hopefully we'll get over this avian flu thing and our, you know, chicken supply will remain safe. And this is something which we should promote. Again, obviously the burger, I mean with eating out, you can see that 1/4 of the children actually had a burger meal when they ate out, and they actually liked eating it. Soft drinks, this is the unfortunate, the negative story as well. With regards to drinks, a lot of children, nearly 1/3, consumed soft drinks mainly all the time, and more than the 1/3 actually enjoyed drinking soft drinks. So this is something which we have to work on. What was also interesting as well, however, there were about 1/4 of the children, about 25%, who actually said that they didn't mind having water. And we sometimes tend to assume that children don't like water. It is not true. Incidentally, yesterday I was talking to some of my students up at university, and some of them actually work in fast food outlets or other outlets, and they said that recently they've been hearing children asking for water. So that is something positive. And please, you know, as adults, let's promote that. So very quickly, with regards to consumption, what was consumed mostly in these different settings was the pasta, pizza, breakfast cereals, fast food style meals and soft drinks. So pastas and pizzas, we need to work on the sauces with the pasta to make them healthier. Now and again, encourage the children to have whole grain pasta as well. With the pizza, we need to work on creating healthier toppings. Breakfast cereals, low sugar and high fiber if possible. Fast food style meals, we can give some hints to children how to eat healthier even in the fast food outlet, such as not having the white sauces, such as maybe not having the larger meal, or sharing the fries, or maybe ordering a salad with the burger, okay, or perhaps even as well sometimes actually opting for a salad rather than always a burger or chicken nuggets, etc. Trying to have a burger which is grilled rather than fried. So there are hints which we can give children, skipping the soft drink and having either milk if it is offered or juice at least, okay? So these are things which we can recommend with regards to fast food style. With regards to soft drinks, I think it's a very unequivocal message here. Let's omit soft drinks from children's diets. They don't need them. Now and again it's okay, but soft drinks are empty calories, no nutrients. Let's omit them from children's diets. Give them water, give them milk, give them fresh fruit juices. What was limited? Yes, I mean, few children were having those three vegetables or fruits daily, yeah? And few children were having at least 2 servings or milk of milk or milk products. So that's something which we need to work on. The last part of this presentation we'll look at what features in specific foods were, in a sense, or could attract children to them, and what features sometimes act as barriers to consumption. Again, these are things which came from the children themselves. So I'm going to focus on fruit and vegetables and snack foods, in particular traditional snack foods. So I was talking to children, and when they said they liked a food, I would ask them, why do you like this food? And through these different questions, I started to get a pattern as to features in different foods which attracted children and features in different foods or circumstances which acted as barriers to consumption. First, we have a set of facilitators. So these were things which children enjoyed about these foods. And then we have barriers, things which the children didn't like about these foods when it comes to vegetables and fruits. These were common for both vegetables and fruits. So if it tasted sweet, if it had it was flavorsome, if it was fresh, if it was soft, if it was juicy, if it had a red color, these features attracted children to both vegetables and fruit. They also mentioned the health value of fruits and vegetables, and again the term vitamins. So they said, I like fruits and vegetables because they're healthy, they have vitamins. And then there's also the convenience factor. I like fruits and vegetables because they're easy to eat. We'll see this a little bit in the next slide or two. We'll see a little bit more about this, about the convenience. Barriers, what were barriers to consumption? If the fruit or vegetable is soft, if it's soggy, or if it's full of seeds, okay? These were barriers to consumption, both for vegetables and for fruits. Again, I'm not saying that all this applies to all children, but many of the children were mentioning these features. To focus just on vegetables, some other facilitators when it came to vegetables, if it's thin or light, these are the words that the children themselves used, and they particularly referred to lettuce. If it's crunchy, and here they referred to carrots, cabbage, lettuce, and even turnip, okay? So they liked these things, they liked the crunchiness of carrots, cabbage, lettuce, and turnip. And if it's round, they liked small round things, and they specifically mentioned the small round potatoes, although one or two children also mentioned the cherry tomatoes, but more so they mentioned the potatoes. Children do like potatoes, okay? So it's okay for them to have potatoes, rather obviously rather than fried, as boiled or roasted, etc. What were barriers to consumption when it comes to vegetables? A very strong flavor, and here they mentioned marrows, arabali, and onion. Or a bitter flavor, and here they mentioned cauliflower. Now this also depends a little bit how it's cooked, eh? So here there are things which, you know, as food providers, those of us who are food providers, oftentimes how we cook the food is going to make a difference. With regards to fruit, what were other facilitators, other features which attracted the children? They liked the creamy taste of banana. This is a word which they kind of used, creamy. They also liked some foods when they were hard, green apples and banana. This was a bit surprising, but yeah, many children said they don't like it soggy. Remember I had said soggy was a barrier or soft, but they liked the banana to be hard, okay? But even green apples, they liked the green apples. They said green apples, okay? They specifically mentioned green apples. And they also liked bambinella because of its being small and cute. They like something which is small, okay? Like a smaller version of something large. So the bambinella is a smaller version of obviously pears, okay? What were barriers? Sour a taste, and here they mentioned again green apples. So unfortunately green apples had positive features but also negative. But some children liked green apples because they liked it hard, other children didn't like green apples because they tasted sour. And then we had black grapes, and they specifically mentioned because they're dry. And this is sometimes true. The black grapes sometimes, not always, tend to be less juicy than the green, all right, the white grapes. So, but again, these were some specific features. With regards to traditional snacks, here I asked a bit about and biscottelli. I myself try to promote the consumption of traditional, healthy traditional foods, amongst others traditional snacks, and so I actually showed children and biscottelli and we spoke about them. And some things which they liked about these foods and which would encourage consumption, they liked the because they were soft, but for some children, unfortunately, that was also a barrier. Some children said the are too soft, they get stuck in their throat. Okay? Biscottelli, we also had mixed reactions. Some liked them because they were hard, some didn't like them because they were too hard. With regards to crunchiness, some liked the crunchy biscottelli, some didn't like the crunchiness. So here, unfortunately, these features were both facilitators and barriers. Then some children mentioned they liked because of the health value, particularly because they didn't have salt and because they didn't have sugar, they said that. They liked and biscottelli because they liked to have them with a drink. They thought the combination, they actually said, because it goes well with tea, it goes well with coffee. Okay, they liked the flavor combination. And then they also liked the enjoyment aspect because you can dunk it, you can dip it. So they liked being able to dip, you know, the and biscottelli in the tea and coffee. Just to quote quickly some, actually to give you some quotes from the children related to these features. One child said, this is with regards to refreshing, the refreshing feature. In summer we'll go and eat on the roof because it's hot and mummy always makes salad. I take salad in summer because it's fresh fruit. I don't take fruit salad, but vegetable salad with lettuce, carrots and cucumber, and when you eat it, it freshens your insides. So the refreshing feature is important, huh? Now, convenience, and I'm going to mention two or three quotes here because I was surprised, in a sense, how convenience can be such a strong influencing factor. Here are some of the things children said. Because the banana is not like the apple, you need to peel the apple with a knife, but the banana you peel with your fingers. Okay, you can even eat an apple with the peel, but this particular child, he or she did not eat apple with the peel, so they felt it was cumbersome and inconvenient that they had to peel the apple, but a banana they liked because you could just go ahead and peel it. This was a really interesting quote or statement by a child. I like those, she was referring to tomatoes, which look like clouds. Okay? So that when I want some, I cut a piece off. And then I said, what do you mean? Because they have grooves, you know? So she could cut with the grooves. So that was very, very perceptive, I thought, as well. But the convenience, she could cut with the grooves. When you try to pick them, here, I remember this was a boy, he was referring to Maros Arabali. When you try to pick them up, they don't want to go on your fork, not even with the spoon. He was frustrated. So obviously, the marrows were too soft, etc., and not easy to pick up. This was an interesting statement by a child. When eating watermelon, you are drinking at the same time. Very interesting. So the convenience, okay, the ease of eating, very important. And as food providers, we need to be aware of these things. Let's make it easy for children to eat the healthy foods. Then there was something interesting as well, is that the children also kind of looked at food as to sort of whether they had them to assuage hunger, so they don't get hungry, you know, to put off hunger or to sort of carry them over whilst they're waiting for food to be prepared. And these are some quotes again. You make a fruit salad with all kinds of fruits. I put whole bran and I add banana, kiwi and strawberries. I do this when I arrive home after school till mommy prepares the food for me. So certain foods are linked with this carrying me over till mom prepares the food. Whilst I'm hungry, I need something. Before I go to private lessons, I take a bowl of fruit with kiwi, apples, banana and oranges. So again, this is something good. In fact, I neglected to mention, when we looked at the snack at home setting, when I looked at the snack at home setting, fruits were the food which were consumed most as a snack at home. So that was a very positive finding. Another quote, even when I go home and mommy hasn't cooked yet, sometimes I have cereal and sometimes I have So children associate certain foods with this, you know, eating something quickly till food is provided or till it's time to eat. This was something interesting. Americanization. Children were sometimes attracted to a food because they associated it with America. Okay? And here we have a particular quote, so children's symbolic adaptation of a local food to fit the image of American food. Because when you eat it's like eating a donut. I pretend to be playing policeman because those in the films, they eat donuts. Then my sister and I eat pretending to be like the policeman. Yes, in the film he has a box of donuts and he gets one and eats it. But it just shows how, you know, again, so the media in a sense is portraying certain images. And if we can use these images to help us to attract children to healthier food, why not? Let's take advantage of that, okay? Jump on the bandwagon, in a sense, and take advantage of the media. So this was an interesting, I mean, it's quite amazing to have a 7-8-year-old say these things, but it just shows all these linkages children are making. So, to start wrapping up, as part of my research, I actually, at the end of all the research, created a model where I looked at the different influences on what children are eating. This is a simple version of the model in the sense that from my findings, I found that family has a strong influence, the mother has a strong influence, the school has a strong influence, but these themselves, these three, if you want to say, factors, are then further influenced by larger forces such as the culture, such as the physical environment, what food is available, and obviously then at the final level, these are again influenced by the natural environment and the human-built environment. This is called an ecological model, and you have different levels of influence. You don't need to read this, but this is actually all the influences, okay? So those are all the influences which emerged from my research as impacting on what children ate. So really and truly, it's a huge, complex situation, okay? When we're trying to, in a sense, manipulate the different factors which will influence what children eat, it's not one item, it's not a single chain, it's all kinds of combinations. What we've done today is just looked at one aspect, and we've looked at the food perceptions, okay, the food preferences, the cognitive, sensorial, and affective aspects of food and what children are, and you know, how children look at food, what they know about food, and a little bit what they are eating. So what are the implications of all of this? Let's come to the dessert. We had the starter, we had the main course, and now this is dessert, the ending. There are a number of implications. Here I'm just going to give you the implications based on what I shared with you today. There are many more implications based on all the research, on all my research. Here I'm calling these specific groups. I'm calling all parents, all caregivers, teachers, school councils, education division, health promotion department, Ministry for Rural Affairs and the Environment, because obviously they're the availability and the agricultural aspect, ITS and local chefs and food manufacturers. What am I trying to suggest? Let's look at implications for educational messages. We need, therefore, to promote the concept of a balanced consumption of food from different food groups. In our messages, yes, some children are already kind of familiar with this idea. Balance in variety, balance in quantity. We need to correct children's misconceptions on the health value and nutrient content of food. There, as you saw, there are certain misconceptions. There are certain inaccuracies, okay? They have inaccurate ideas about food and their link with health. We need to correct these in our lessons, in our messages, as we're talking to children. When it comes to nutrients, we must not really go into detail. It's beyond the young children, 7, 8-year-olds. It's not fair to try to burden them with nutrition science. Let's stick to food, the food level. So limit messages on nutrient and health links to only a few key nutrients and associations. Avoid creating negative images and associations. Here's what I'm referring to, just to refresh your memory, is the milk and obesity and cholesterol, the brown bread and the diabetic, the brown bread and the elderly people. Let's try to avoid talking about these foods in such a manner in front of children, because they will make these associations and it will be difficult for us to promote these foods with our children. Encourage now when it comes to actual behavior. What are they consuming? Let's encourage children to eat more what we call complex carbohydrates, such as the wholemeal pasta, because they love pasta, the wholemeal bread, because they love bread, the whole grain breakfast cereals, they like the cereals. So let's just try and make it healthier. Help children eat more vegetables and fruits, and today maybe you've got some ideas as to what are those attributes which attract children to vegetables and fruits. So let's use those attributes to encourage them to eat more fruits and vegetables. Expose children to a variety of low salt, low sodium, and low sugar snacks. Apart from fruit, let's also share with them and encourage them and make available traditional snacks such as the A and the biscotelli, which are not high in fat, not high in sugar, and not high in salt, and also the local traditional Hobbs Bizzait. Try to make it with fresh vegetables, try to make it with unsalted bainit, maybe tuna as well, but let's encourage, you know, our children and let's make these foods available. Urge children to drink more water. Let's try and move away from all those soft drinks. Encourage children to have milk, water, or fresh fruit juices rather than soft drinks as a beverage accompaniment to both snacks or during meals. One little thing which I didn't mention was children do not tend to mention milk as a drink to accompany meals. Usually with meals they'll have either water or a soft drink many times. Well, let's get them used to the idea that milk can also accompany your meal. Okay, not just as a in-between drink or as a drink with a snack, but even you can have milk with your main meal. Work with children to develop healthy spreads for breads and ah. They love the ah as well, but some of them were saying, I toasted and I spread, believe it or not, one of them said Nestle cream. Wow, I said. So they are sometimes having this healthier food, but unfortunately making it a little bit unhealthy, spreading Nestle cream or jam. So let's try and work with them in the classroom. Let's create healthy spreads, okay, for these and for the bread, and also healthy toppings for the pizzas. And we can also help children, as I gave you some tips, with guidelines on how to eat healthier even when they are at a fast food outlet. I think it's difficult to totally ban children from going to fast food outlets. Again, I think probably many of us here as well often also or sometimes patronize fast food outlets, so we can't ban children from going there, but certainly we can help them, as we help ourselves, to make healthier options. Last set of implications, and here in a sense I'm addressing chefs, ITS lecturers and students. From ITS, we probably don't have anybody here, but maybe you have acquaintances and you can pass on these messages. These people need to develop attractive healthy dishes for children's restaurant menus. Basically, it's the kids' menus in restaurants are very stereotypical. You generally have your things like some kind of fried meal, okay, or pizzas or chicken nuggets. Unfortunately, often there is a fried component to it, and very few restaurants are offering much in the sense of a healthy alternative. It is quite a shame. I was actually just at a restaurant this weekend and looking, I always look at the kids' menu, and the irony of it was that the menu said it was offering the pizza with the sausages on top, and then it said in brackets, and a free soft drink. And I felt like, wah! You know, screaming. So unfortunately, not only were they giving them this pizza with the sausages, but also even offering, gently and kindly offering, a free soft drink, which is such a shame. So, chefs, etc., ITS lecturers, students need to work on creating healthier dishes for the kids' menu, okay? Now here, you know, home economics teachers and food technology teachers could come in because they could start working on these products in their classroom, okay? And then many of our home economics students actually go on to ITS. So this could be sort of one way of doing this. Let's train them in our classrooms and then they go off to ITS and they can share these ideas with the rest of the students, lecturers, and so on. And finally, what about local food manufacturers? Well, we do have, you know, we have traditional snacks, we have these abs, kuteli, and other foods. Let's make them more attractive for children, maybe even the packaging which they're in, okay? Let's make them attractive for children because these are foods which we should be promoting. And, you know, or maybe the local food manufacturers can come up and develop with, come up with and develop new healthy snacks. Which have the attributes which children like, which are, you know, a little bit strong, soft, maybe a bit crunchy. So these are things which manufacturers can work on. This is just time to make you hungry. These are the foods which we would love to promote. Obviously not only these, but these are the foods which I've been mentioning. You know, the local biscottelli, the rabbit stew, the hops bezeit, the fresh fruit, the fruit milkshakes, the ftira. Some of you, probably or many of you are familiar with this. It's the gossetin ftira. Again, it's tuna, vegetables, potatoes rather than cheese, okay? These are the things which we should be promoting. So I'd like to conclude by saying I think all of us here should try to leave today with this idea and maybe this plan of action for ourselves in our different settings, in our different environments, to make healthy local and traditional foods the preferred choice, but also the easy choice for the younger generation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Piscopo, for your very comprehensive and thorough study. Now it's time for questions.
First of all, thank you, Suzanne, for your great presentation. More than a question, well, I have one question, actually. You mentioned the issue of coffee. Mm-hmm. And was it something common in the habits of, you know, 7 and 8 year old children drinking it?
Yes, well, there were a number of children, I believe it was maybe 1 in 10, to be honest, who did actually have for breakfast, let's say, coffee and a piece of bread. So yes, it was being given to children often, or you can say most of the times, that's why I had drawn it like that, it was offered with milk. So again, probably the parent or the caregiver was saying, well, I'm giving the child milk, so it's okay to have coffee. Coffee in itself, if children don't, you know, consume it too often, it is not harmful. I mean, having coffee now, if they just have it once a day, it should not be detrimental. It is a source, obviously, of caffeine. The problem would be if they have many other sources of caffeine throughout the day, such as through certain soft cola, soft drinks, for example. If they have a lot of cola, soft drinks, they're having a lot of caffeine, then they should avoid having a lot of coffee as well, and maybe even chocolate. I remember that chocolate can also be a source of caffeine. So if they're having lots of cold drinks, lots of caffeine from the chocolate, lots of caffeine from the cold drinks, and then coffee itself, that's where one would have to be careful.
Okay, thank you. And one more thing.
Yes, of course.
Another research which was carried out locally does correlate totally with the cereal and milk issue which you mentioned. In fact, 92% to state that they have cereal with milk. Did you actually investigate what kind of cereal was taken? Because I've got data which states that 48% from the 92 is actually chocolate-based cereals. Mm-hmm. Which makes a big difference as regards to health issues.
Yes, definitely. That's actually a very good perception. Within the data with regards to the quantity as to how many were consuming cereals, in my case, this was nearly kind of 50%. Now, that was via survey. But within the focus groups, I didn't specifically ask, I'll be honest, with regards to what kind of cereal you're consuming. But this kind of information emerged. And they were mentioning, I'm going to mention the brand names, it doesn't matter here, but they were mentioning things like Frosties, Cocoa, Pops, okay, the Rice Krispies, but mainly the Cocoa Pops, in fact, and Frosties as the key. Some of them mentioned the Graham crackers and honey-coated cereals as well. So yes, high sugar, okay? That's why I said we need to work with the children by exposing them to other cereals. You may start off with, you know, mixing sort of a high sugar cereal with a lower sugar cereal, and kind of weaning them off gently if you want to. Sometimes, you know, just literally stopping, not providing a certain cereal, introducing a new one to them and introducing it in a way which is fun is enough for them to switch to another cereal. Just actually to continue on that very quickly, the chocolate obviously is an attraction to children as it is maybe to us adults as well, and it's something which in a way we cannot escape. When they had things like bread with Nutella as one of the options which they could choose from, although they didn't consume, for example, bread with Nutella so often as a snack at home, but when I asked them whether they would prefer that, yes, that's when the numbers went up. They would prefer having bread with Nutella, okay? When I asked them about milk, school milk, because I was particularly keen on finding out about school milk, and it was again mixed. I mean, some children actually liked white milk, but I would not be fair if I didn't say that a lot of children liked the chocolate milk, okay? So that is something which is a bit of an issue if we're going to be looking at milk and school milk. Again, it could be a factor that maybe at school they will have the white milk, and then at home, if they wish to, they can have the flavored milk if the parents want to do so.
Okay. Any other questions, please? Were you surprised by the findings?
Was I surprised? I think some of the findings, in a sense, were expected, but we didn't really have any. No research had been done to date, in a sense, to be able to verify, quantify, etc. We have had, you know, different research being done also by undergraduate students within our different departments, which also had always given us some ideas. Some things which were surprising, in a sense, were that I knew. Yes, that pizza and pasta were sort of key foods in children's diet, but then they emerged in so many different settings. So it was like evening meal after school, when they go out to eat. So in a sense, you know, pizza and pasta were pervasive in their meals. And also soft drinks, that they were consuming so many soft drinks. I mean, I knew they were consuming soft drinks, but the fact that, you know, you had so many children consuming soft drinks, that was surprising. Then when it comes to the convenience factor, all these different aspects of convenience and how it's eaten, you know, how easy it is to eat, how accessible it is, these things also were quite surprising that the children were aware. I mean, I didn't mention during the presentation, but they were also aware of the convenience with regards to their parents. And they were aware of the fact that, and I mentioned this because the children mentioned it, they were aware of the fact that mothers maybe were very busy in the morning, they needed to go out to work as well, and sometimes the mothers didn't have time to prepare a lunch. And the children actually said this to me, because my mom is really in a hurry in the morning. I remember one child saying like, yes, mom promises me to, let's say, put lettuce and tomato in my bread, but then she forgets because she's in a hurry. I mean, these are the kinds of statements they made. Or let's say, yes, mom was going to squeeze me an orange, but she didn't have time, so she told me to take orange squash. And now, not blaming the moms. Again, here it's something where we need to help the moms, not blame the moms, okay? Yes, the moms are still the main food providers. There are two key things which we can do is, one, as moms, as dads, as caregivers, we can actually help the children so that they themselves start making their own lunch at age 7, 8. They are capable enough of making a sandwich, okay, and of putting a fruit in their packed lunch. So this is something which we could work on to help each other. With regards to parents and caregivers, we can actually help them, give them tips and ideas on how to prepare different packed lunches, which you can prepare from the evening before, etc. Or you can prepare a number ahead, freeze them, take them out of the freezer, etc. So there are certain things which we can do, and this is a task maybe for us as educators, where we try to help or give tips to parents on how to cook healthy or prepare healthy packed lunches in particular, or healthy meals really, in a short time.
So. Suzanne, what a really fascinating study. And I found your findings very interesting, especially in terms of apparently Malta scores very high on the obesity, childhood obesity rate in European countries or the new European countries. So I found your findings fascinating, and I hope some people, you know, the people in authority, listen to what you found, and because that might explain, help us understand why we have such high obesity rates in children. What I'm interested in is, why did you choose 7 to 8 year olds? Why that age group? And also, I'm really interested, I was quite fascinated as well with the detail, as you said, of the sort of vitamins and these kind of descriptions. And also, the other thing I'm interested in is, was it hard to get them to talk about food? Or did they talk easily, especially in those focus groups?
Mm-hmm. Okay, good question. Why did I choose 7 to 8 year olds? Well, the whole, in a sense, goal behind all of this research is that I want to be able to have information so that when it comes to actually developing food and nutrition curricula for our children, for Maltese children, the curricula will be based on their needs. So I need to find out what they know, their meanings around food and health, what they perceive, what they're actually eating, so we'll find out, you know, what they're doing well and where we need to work upon. So that is why I chose 7 to 8 year olds, because even at age 7 and 8, in a sense, some people might say it's too late to start changing habits, but maybe if we tried to educate, in a sense, and give a lot of information earlier, they might not understand. We can start talking about, you know, food and health even at age 4 and 5, but obviously you have to remain at a very, very simple level. But at age 7 and 8, as you saw, they are really ready to understand and assimilate information and maybe pick up certain skills as well. When it comes to talking about food, I can assure you they loved talking about food. Okay. Also, to be honest, when I did the focus groups, I had originally planned for, let's say, a half an hour focus group, but they started talking and talking and talking, and some focus groups lasted an hour and a half. But the thing was, I didn't just talk. The focus group was kind of divided into 3 phases, and the first phase, I actually took out real food products. Okay, and we spoke about these real food products. Then the second phase was just conversation, in a sense, without any props. And then the third phase was with food photos. So it made it interactive and dynamic and enjoyable for the children. If you do work with children, you need to make it fun for them. Huh? Even the survey, it wasn't a pen and paper survey as we would normally use. Those pictures which I showed you where you had to choose, those were the actual pictures I used during the survey. Okay, so they didn't just have text, they actually had 6 pictures every time, and they ticked, or they ticked the picture of the food they consumed most, or they ticked the picture of the food which they would prefer most in that particular setting. So it was, the important thing is when you work with children, you make it fun. And in a sense, that will also help to make the environment non-threatening when they're answering you, and you're more likely to get valid answers. Okay, thanks for that question as well.
So when you compare your findings with international data, how do we fare?
Okay, very good. When it comes to nutrition knowledge, with certain things we were comparable, let's say the links between sugar and fat and obesity and that fruits and vegetables are healthy, etc. These were common findings, in the sense they were comparable to other countries as well, such as Europe and North America. What was interesting and some things which stood out were that the link the Maltese children were making between fat and heart health. Obviously, they are hearing a lot about it in their families or on the media here in Malta. So children, the Maltese children stood out as talking about cholesterol, Yidiulvini, you know, Lija Millek il-ħsar al-qalb. So there they stood out as being quite knowledgeable, more than their foreign counterparts, with regards to the link between certain foods and heart health. Obviously, in contrast then, in many countries abroad, they link milk with bones and growth, and this is where we had a deficiency here in Malta. They didn't link milk with bone health and growth. They mainly linked it just with dental health. So that is something where we need to work on. With regards to actual food intake, I can tell you it was quite comparable, okay? I mean, if you look at most westernized countries, yes, their children are having the fast food meals, yes, their children are having the pizza, yes, their children are having the pasta. So it was quite comparable. comparable. Again, also the deficiency in not having maybe enough fruits and vegetables. So unfortunately, there, in a sense, we were similar, but it's in a negative trend. What I did find interesting was that, you know, quite a few children here in Malta did talk about this aspect of balance. And how, so again, they are receiving this message either from the school or elsewhere that you need to balance. You have a variety of foods and not too much of anything. So that was kind of interesting finding. And from research which I've done, when research was conducted with adults in the US, these adults said that if in their childhood they had been told about this aspect and concept of balance, as older adults, now that they were adults, they found it easier to control their food intake. So in a sense, it augurs well. If our children are already, in a way, being weaned onto this idea of balance, hopefully when they are older, it'll help them a little bit also when they are controlling their own diet.
Yes, Susan, I take you back to the educational settings. I was very happy to find out, one of my students, okay, actually found out that in some of the local state schools, there is a nutrition policy being carried out in the schools. And within this nutrition policy, schools actually check on the on the students' lunches. Mm-hmm. And they make a good, they focus on healthy spreads and a lot of drinking and consuming of water, which will put everything into a good picture, clear picture. One thing which also I remember well from the reading I made, that some parents actually suggested that the possibility, I'm not discussing the social issue, the social implications of this, that it would be a good idea to actually introduce school meals for children over there, because given that both parties sometimes work for long hours, they are interested in seeing the possibility of students having good meals in schools, where they will be guaranteed a good balanced diet, mm-hmm. rather than going back home and having the quick. In fact, it was quite evident that quick meals are the pizzas mm-hmm. and the pastas, even though they are quite healthy. I mean, if they're prepared the right way. Also, some schools are also investing in putting up reverse osmosis plants in schools for the excess of water, which is a brilliant idea, and I think it should be pointed out.
Yes, thanks for mentioning that. In fact, at the moment, the National Curriculum Council is actually working on developing a draft school food policy. I also have Catherine Polidano here, who is a colleague and who's also working on this policy together with me and some other people as a task force. And in fact, what you mentioned, Ivan, we did conduct a survey over October and November. We sent out the survey to all the state schools and non-state schools, and we're more or less finishing analyzing the results, and these things did emerge. There are some state schools and non-state schools who have school food policies. With some of them, they actually implement and monitor quite rigorously. With others, I'll be honest, they say they have the policy, but maybe for different reasons, it's not really enforced so thoroughly. Some of them, yes, did. Actually, the class teacher did check, you know, literally pack lunch by pack lunch what the children are consuming. With others, as I said, they do have the policy, but it's literally, it's there and it's kind of, you know, touch and go as to how much it's being implemented. Hopefully through this task force, we'll try to come up with recommendations and guidelines which will be feasible. That is what we are aiming for. However, I think probably most of you here, and I'm sure I feel confident that even the task force I'm working with on this policy, feel very strongly that the school should really be a role model when it comes to what foods are provided on the premises and what foods are promoted. And that's something which I think we should really rally for as people who truly want the well-being of our children. Okay? And with regards to the water, what is interesting, yes, actually from the survey we found that as well, that either they're investing in the reverse osmosis or they're buying the huge, you know, the containers of water and making water available. And I can tell you this is something which we will suggest as a task force. I don't think really I'm giving letting the cat out of the bag here, but it is something which we will promote, that water is made available to school children. That is something which is happening even internationally. Water is made freely available to school children. Ideally, this would come about also in our schools, obviously clean, potable water.
Perhaps a question which could be goes beyond the remit of your study. I mean, how does nutrition, you know, awareness and knowledge intersect with, for example, social class?
Ah, okay. Well, actually, that was a part of my study, which I didn't mention. What I did was, and I'll try to sort of put this in a nutshell, I looked, it's difficult sometimes to assess or to classify when it comes to social class. I mean, Malta, really, it's quite a problem because what criteria are you going to use? You're going to, okay, look at family income, you're going to look at educational background of, let's say, the adults in the household. Well, I couldn't ask, you know, about income, etc., to the children, and I didn't actually ask about income to the parents either. I had discussed this with my supervisors, and we felt we might not get accurate answers to be able to classify the families. So what I did, the best I could do at that stage was, I looked at, rather than social class in a sense, I looked at the different schools, and I looked at schools which were fee-paying versus schools which were not fee-paying, and I kind of used a little bit that criteria to help me assess maybe different family backgrounds and different family settings. What was interesting was this, I'll just give you one or two ideas. What stood out was that children who attended independent schools, rather than with regards to knowledge, it was more with regards to behaviors. Children who attended independent schools, they were the children, for example, who did not have family meals so often. They tended to have their meal on their own. In contrast, for example, I'll give you one idea, children from state schools, particularly from Gosseton state schools, I had 98% of the children saying all their meals were taken with the family. Okay, with independent school children, I just had 70% roughly of those independent school children saying that they had meals together with their family. Their weekend, their weekday evening meal was taken with the family. That was 70% versus 95-98% independent school children versus the other children. With regards to consumption, then what was interesting was this. When the independent school children, this also reflects actually, you know, theory and other research from abroad, the independent school children were the innovators, in a sense also because of maybe their financial situation and their families. They mentioned the newer food. Newer foods in a sense of, or the newer trends in food consumption. There were more independent school children who consumed water. Okay, it is sort of the in thing, the fashionable thing, etc., to consume water. You had more independent school children doing that. You had more state school children still consuming, let's say, the juices or the soft drinks. You had more independent school children mentioning things like soya milk, for example. I remember a few children actually mentioning soya milk. Versus, you know, these newer foods, these newer trends were not mentioned so frequently, or you can say they were absent amongst the state school children. On the other hand, then, the state school and church school children were those children who tended to mention more often the traditional foods. They were the children who were mentioning the patat al forn, the marun al forn, fennec, okay? What was interesting was you had the independent school children seeking these foods, the rabbit, when they go out to eat. So you had more independent school children wanting to eat rabbit when they go out to eat, for example. So this is where you kind of see these differences according to school background, but in a sense based also a little bit on family background.
Okay, Dr. Piscopo, thank you once again for your presentation. Okay, and
thank you.
And I just want to remind you that you can access the electronic journal mm-hmm. freely by clicking on www.educ.um.edu.mt/jmem. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you and good evening. Thank you.
You have just listened to a JMER lecture, Chew on This, exploring Maltese children's food and nutrition knowledge, perceptions and behaviours by Dr. Suzanne Piscopo.